This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Brewski, Stacy Cole, and Todd Michaels.
Well, if you were watching anything over the weekend about the Reiner case, you may have seen TMZ has just dropped a documentary that puts into words what a lot have been thinking, but couldn't quite articulate. Sources with direct knowledge now say Nick Reiner admits to killing his parents, but reportedly doesn't understand why he's in jail. He allegedly believes his incarceration is part of a conspiracy against him. Meanwhile, the murder weapon still hasn't been found. The autopsy reports have been sealed by the LAPD, and legal experts are predicting this case won't see a courtroom for at least 2 years. To help us understand what investigators are dealing with right now and what the behavioral evidence actually tells us, Jennifer Coffendaffer, retired FBI special agent, is with us. Jen, welcome. Happy new week here. Let's start with the admission itself. Sources say Nick knows he killed his parents, but believes the people who put him behind bars are engaged in a conspiracy against him. I'm curious as to what your take is on this. Is this someone, you know, with obviously mental illness is real, but he also has a track record of manipulating anyone and everyone around him to get them to look at him in a certain light? What do you think we're dealing with right now that he's behind bars?
You know, exactly, Tony. First of all, anyone who is an addict of this degree lives their life in a complete lie. So every time they open their mouth, it's very difficult to know what is truth and what is false. And typically, it's a lot of false. Secondarily to that, I want to see the whole statement. I know this is source information, blah, blah. But if he gave some sort of a confession of sorts, it's going to be very, very involved. It's not just going to be a sentence or two. And I would love to see the full context.
Can we see it? Is it available somewhere?
Not that I know of.
Okay.
Yeah. What exactly is going on in the investigations from an investigative standpoint right now? I mean, obviously, it seems pretty clear cut that he did this. Allegedly, he's admitting to it. So, I mean, that's fairly established. You can, I'm sure, find, you know, and they are finding a lot of, you know, ring camera videos, security camera videos of him wandering the streets, trying to put together that timeline of what happened between the party and that night and him being back at the house and the murders and all of that and him being arrested. Great. But at the end of the day, if he says he did it, what sort of investigative points are really being made here or will be made by whatever they're finding, if at the end of the day this all kind of comes down to more of a mental health defense and mental health principles, not so much were you the one that did it?
Right. I love how you couch that, because of course they're going to be looking at the A to Z in terms of that actual time leading up to the crime and after the crime in terms of the steps he took physically, right? And that's what you're talking about. But what's the bigger picture? The real bigger picture that law enforcement is going to want to focus on is premeditation, what steps he took, where did he get the knife, when did he reserve the hotel room, how long has he been thinking about committing this crime, what is his footprint from his digital evidence as far as researching anything about committing such a murder? And then afterwards, what did he do to cover it up? We know he went to a hotel room. We know he took a shower. We know the knife is nowhere to be found. Those are indications of him understanding right from wrong. If he would have been caught sitting on the front porch, you know, with knife in hand going, I don't know really what happened. That's a big difference from covering up a crime. That's what they're going to concentrate on.
And that's consciousness of guilt. That's what we've been hearing everybody talk about. That's what you're alluding to, correct?
Yeah, consciousness of guilt. Did he understand, more importantly, not just consciousness of guilt, but to expand, really understanding right from wrong and taking steps to cover it up? That's what law enforcement's going to be looking for.
Taking steps to cover it up. I guess that's the interesting part. I mean, do we have anything that looks like this is being covered up? Because from what we've seen thus far, you know, showing up at the hotel. Allegedly, there was a lot of blood in the shower and such, and the hotel still said, got to get the room flipped, so let's clean it. Do we have anything that shows a cover-up here, or do we just show someone who seems to have gone out and done this and doesn't seem to understand the gravity of the situation?
No, I think that shows cover-up. Whenever you go someplace that is unusual, unless he always goes to that hotel on that particular evenings, on that those particular nights, and has often frequented there, he changes clothes. Again, the knife is nowhere to be found. He leaves the murder location. All of those indicate cover-up. But they're going to get into very specifics of all that. At least that's what they're going to look for. They're also going to look for his Google searches, as I mentioned. Did he Google how to get rid of a knife, how to clean blood out of clothes, how to clean up, you know, after you commit murder? Those types of Google searches, it's possible we're going to see those.
And let's say they find them. But how much does that then play into the mental health area of this, where it's by reason of insanity? Because you can have people that are having a psychotic break, carrying out all of these things, because they're at that moment in time not fully understanding the gravity of what they're doing. They can understand what they're doing is wrong, but if they don't fully grasp what that all means, that's where you get into the weird technicalities of an insanity defense. And, you know, some may look at that and go, you know, BS, but it is what it is. I mean, that's how they look at these sort of cases if they actually make it to trial.
The legal point on this is crystal clear. Did they know right from wrong? And mm-hmm. how investigators show that one way or the other is looking at premeditation combined with looking at cover-up. Mm-hmm. So if we get premeditation and cover-up, if they're able to show that, he's cooked.
What's your thoughts on, and I found this interesting in the TMZ doc that came out, the reason for the medication change. And medication changes, in case someone is unaware, they happen very frequently. Mm-hmm. In fact, you know, most people, if you do have a long-term debilitating, whether it's a disease, whether it's a disorder, whether it's high blood pressure, whatever it may be, whatever med they put you on initially, eventually your body is going to say, not working so well anymore. And that does get changed over time for almost any ailment that one may be on a long-term plan for. But the reason in this case for switching the meds wasn't that. It wasn't, well, Nick's been on this for a long time, the liver's absorbing it, and it's not as effective as it used to be. It's more so he was gaining weight, allegedly. And that's the reason they decided, maybe we should switch some meds up here, even though you're in a nice stable place compared to the hellscape that you've been in. But, oh, you're putting on those extra pounds. I get it. People make this choice all the time on medications mm-hmm. because of weight gain. But at the same point, I mean, what's your thoughts on this? I mean, it's easy to Monday morning quarterback it and look back and go, well, that was a bad idea. He should have just dealt with it. But at the same point, what is your reaction to that new piece of information that's come out?
Well, Tony, this guy, Nick Reiner, is probably one of the cases of the most spoiled and entitled individuals that I've ever seen. When I watch his own words coming out of his mouth, when I've tried to grab a hold of everything I can to get a feel for Nick Reiner, and then watching all of his actions throughout his life. Look, he controlled everything, and whatever he wanted done, he snapped his fingers, and he snapped his fingers on this one. Oh, I'm getting a little fat. Can you please change my medication? Look at the amount of money they were paying monthly for his care. So basically, whatever he wanted, he was going to get. And we saw him manipulate that actually in a situation where they withheld meds, and then he started acting crazy and threw a rock out a window. This is a manipulating addict who wants his way, and if he doesn't get it, he does what it takes to get it. And that's my opinion on Nick Reiner overall.
Yeah. I mean, and that's the reality of so many addicts. They will do, I mean, the addiction will win unless it's treated and unless the person who has it wants to actively participate in their recovery. A big detail that is standing out in this yet, and I don't know how much weight it has in this case. In a lot of cases, it's usually a big deal. But this one, some sources say it's of limited investigative value. I'm, of course, talking about the murder weapon has not yet been found. How important is it that the murder weapon is recovered in this case?
Well, I can't agree on that one with the LAPD. Look, when you get the murder weapon, that's critical. It's amazing because, first of all, you're going to have likely or possibly, I should say, DNA or fingerprints on that weapon itself. So that's really important for the investigation. Also, when you find the location it was ditched at, that's important too. It can show, in this case, cover up. If he went and buried it someplace, gave it to a friend, put it in a place that only he's familiar with, all of that helps with the cover-up portion that we spoke about earlier, Tony. So to say it's really not that important, I just can't agree with that.
Does it hold any bearing, though, on convicting him? If he's admitted to doing it, what does it matter if they have it or whether he threw it in the dumpster at a 7-Eleven as he was wandering around the streets?
Look, we've got the meat and potatoes.
Yeah.
I agree with what happened, but man, it is nice to have dessert.
Yeah.
And dessert is that knife.
Yeah, you want your toppings on your dessert sundae. I feel like it's the toppings. I feel like it's, you know, it's the M&Ms or the sprinkles or whatever. And it's not quite a complete sundae without it, but it's still a sundae, and it can still be satisfied. We have multiple people saying that there was a lot of welfare checks at the Reiner home over the years involving Nick, where, you know, law enforcement literally came to the door. Hey, we want to make sure everybody's okay. From an investigative standpoint, and then we get into the legal aspect of this once we get to court, I mean, how valuable are those prior incident reports going to be for the prosecution or the defense in establishing a pattern of behavior in some way, shape, or form?
Well, certainly it's a double-edged sword, and I think in many cases they can be used just as that. The defense will sort of twist it to show this continued pattern of, you know, incompetency and mental illness and struggling. And the prosecution will say, see, this guy is a wreck. He was, had violent incidents. He had incidents of, you know, where police had to respond, and it was building until this is what it culminated in. So I see it going either way, depending on your slant.
Just out of curiosity, do you think that there was something that the Reiners were planning on doing, that his parents were maybe going to start withholding the money or kick him out or have him committed maybe, and as a motive that, okay, they're going to pull the rug out from underneath me, this is what's going to happen? Or do you think he just snapped? I mean, what's your gut tell you?
Well, not really going from my gut, Stacy, but really going from experience, there is almost always what I call a proximal event. Some event that happened. We know the party at the O'Briens, but what happened after? And I truly believe there was some heated talk, heated discussion. Maybe we're going to cut you off. Maybe we're just done, Nick. You're back on the streets. We don't know. But there was a proximal event. I think that was it. What exactly was said, it might come out. Look, in the digital footprint, I mean, Nick might have, you know, texted his sister or texted somebody he's close to and said, oh, my God, they're going to throw me out again. We're going to see a lot more depending on what they're able to pull from that. And I'll tell you what, if he decided to wipe his phone or delete some of that, that's another beautiful, beautiful piece of evidence the investigators are going to want to show.
What if he didn't wipe his phone? What if everything's there? Does that show incompetence?
Not really, because a lot of people in a moment like that, he's never committed a double homicide. Most people have it, and they make mistakes. They don't clean well enough. They, you know, decide to book a hotel and wash off there. They make so many mistakes. They're seen on camera. So it wouldn't surprise me at all that he wouldn't have. I just don't know how really bright Nick Reiner really is when it comes to thinking about the steps to cover up.
Death penalty is on the table as of right now. We don't know exactly. You know, some sources say the family, the surviving members are not for it. If one were to make an educated guess based on their previous stances on situations, one would guess they're probably not for the death penalty. But that doesn't mean they're not for having him face consequences and be locked away for the rest of his life. But it is still on the table. The state may want the death penalty. Where do you think that's going to go? And how much weight do you think the decision may process is going to put on the surviving family members' opinion versus what the state wants to ultimately do here?
Well, first of all, it's critical to understand what state we're dealing with, which is California. And California has a moratorium on the death, on using the death penalty. So with that being said, Tony, it's sort of a moot determination, in my opinion. I don't think the death penalty is going to be exercised or is coming back anytime soon to California. But can it be used as a bargaining chip? I think that's the only reason it's on the table. This case should be pled out. That's my opinion. The evidence is overwhelming. They should get rid of the death penalty, lock this guy up for the rest of his life in prison, and he can make his, you know, medication in the toilet like everybody else does that's an addict that goes into prison. Wow, I'm spicy today.
Yeah, you are.
Yeah, I have to agree with you. I mean, in a prison or a mental health facility for the rest of his life, one of the two, I mean, neither are pleasant. If anyone thinks that, like, you know, the mental type health facility that he would be going to in a state facility is anything like the, you know, passages of Malibu or wherever the hell he had gone on the and I'm just throwing random ones out there that I know the names of, that are, you know, more resorts seemingly than actual treatment facilities. That's not where he would end up. Both can be very brutal places. Both can be very dangerous. As far as where he ends up, that's the question. I do want to go back just for a second because we're talking about, were his parents sitting there going and saying, okay, back to the streets, good luck, we're done, we're withdrawing our support. You know, I'm wondering if that was it. You know, I almost think if you're the addict, you may be going, all right, carte blanche to use again, and nobody's going to stop me. You know, or is it more, as we've heard rumors of, were they getting ready to execute a conservatorship? There have been talk of that, allegedly, that they were really seriously contemplating that. And I'm wondering, I mean, if you're the addict and you know your supply is not only getting cut off, not only your autonomy, your allowance, your, you know, access to whatever you're going to get outside of your parents' home, but a conservatorship where, you know, you may be institutionalized somewhere because they have the power and authority to do so, that's a powerful thing to put in front of an addict like that and someone who's mentally ill, where the one thing they want more than anything is to find that next fix. That seems like that could be a real tipping point for an individual of Nick's ilk, in my opinion.
Yeah, absolutely agree with you here, Tony, because certainly that was purportedly discussed. And was that discussed that night after that party? I don't know how much they would tip their hand. And I only say it because of this. Anybody who was getting legal advice about this type of a situation, a conservatorship, would be told, you don't want to discuss this with Nick. Mm-hmm. You know, this, you do not want to set him off with what your plans are. But nevertheless, in a heat of the moment, after being having an embarrassing moment,
I was gonna say that.
Both people just, one humiliated, the other one humiliated, all of that. You never know what was said, and I would never want to truly speculate at what was said, but I believe it was the proximal event.
It makes you wonder, you know, in the heat of it, because they do believe that Nick and Michelle were alive or were awake or conscious when this all went down. They were allegedly in different rooms, excuse me. And you can almost see it. You can almost see, you did this, you know, like, this is why we want to do the conservatorship. This, you know, I'm just pure speculation, but you can almost see this going on and then something clicking in his mind going, well, that's the cutoff point of everything for me. And then it's fight or flight. And he chose the first option in that. Yeah. I don't know. There's a lot of questions, and we'll continue to watch this and see where it all goes. I got to ask you this, because this happened after we talked last week. One more on this. Alan Jackson withdrawing from the case. Mm-hmm. Obviously, a lot of people are looking this at it as a money situation. We don't know for sure exactly why it was. What is the Coffendaffer opinion on why Alan Jackson is no longer part of this?
Money, money, money. Yeah. Look, he threw his hat in the ring because of fame, notoriety, all the reasons he represents Spacey and Weinstein. Same type of situation. This brought headlines. It's in his neck of the woods. It was the perfect one to get in on until, and this is the bigger point that I wanted to make. Why aren't there funds anymore? You know why? In my opinion, the family has also been made up to speed, at least to some degree, on the evidence against him. And probably that confession. In other words, law enforcement, I believe in this case, would share a little bit more than they normally do. And I think they said, this is it for us. He's on his own. He'll have a public defender. Public defenders, by the way, are great. I tell you, if somebody I knew was in trouble, I would want to get one of the best public defenders way over private counsel. Because I'll tell you what, in my experience with private counsel, and I've had cases with 50 defendants and 48 defendants, where they had the most high power attorneys that were in the state. And I tell you what, when I sat there in my room with all my discovery, all the boxes, open discovery is how I handled everything. They would come in the room and look everything over. And you know who I never saw were those private attorneys.
And we actually did some research on this on a piece last week on this. Your odds of winning the case are much higher with a public defender than with a private attorney when it comes to a capital case in California. There's just a much higher rate there. And it makes sense because they see more of it. They deal with this level of charge more frequently than a private attorney would. So if you have more reps in it, you would naturally probably do better. It's not like he's getting a bad attorney here. She has many years of experience. We'll see where this goes. If it ever even makes it to trial, we'll, of course, keep following it. Your thoughts in the comments section. Let's move on to another story, another trial that is about to begin. The Brendan Banfield murder trial. It is beginning this week and before a single witness takes the stand. This case already has some serious problems, I guess, depending on how you're looking at it. The prosecution's own digital forensic expert concluded their catfishing theory doesn't hold up. He was then transferred out of the unit. The lead homicide detective who pushed back on the command staff's theory was reassigned too. And the original lead prosecutor was removed after being cited for drinking at 8 a.m. So what happens when an investigation starts with a conclusion and works backwards to find the facts? Jennifer Coffendaffer, retired FBI special agent, is here to help us kind of break this down. Let's start with Officer Brendan Miller, who analyzed 60 devices and concluded that Christine Banfield, not her husband, appeared to control the FetLife account. His findings were also peer-reviewed by the University of Alabama and confirmed. And then they said, you're never going to do this again. We don't like your findings. They don't necessarily go along with with the story that we believe happened. Jen, from your experience, how significant is it when your forensic expert contradicts the theory and now he's, you know, no longer in that position?
It's significant. Look, Tony, my favorite evidence always is digital evidence and evidence that doesn't have an opinion and doesn't have a heartbeat. I want to see where the actual facts lead that aren't opinions, they're actual facts. And I can tell you, because back in the day, we got to actually talk to jurors afterwards. Any juror who wanted to stay behind, we could talk to them and discuss, and they will tell you the same thing. In my experience, they love that. it's well above witnesses. So when you have somebody with this, his type of credentials and with the amount of evidence he reviewed, I just got to go with the facts.
Yeah. And this is an interesting case because on the surface, it looks like, oh, well, they check all the boxes here where it must be this. But when you dig deeper, it's like, whoa, wait a second here. I mean, this is why crossing the T's and dotting the I's is important. But here it looks like they did cross the T's and dot the I's. Mm-hmm. It's just that the prosecution didn't like the letters they were using. It's like, we'd like a different font, please. This one doesn't quite match up to the font that we're using over here. And it's like, well, sorry, that's the font that came with this package. According to the court testimony, Deputy Chief Brush told Miller that he would never work another digital forensic case for the Bureau. Miller was then transferred. The lead detective was reassigned. What does it tell you when investigators who push back on the theory get moved off the case?
That's not good.
Well, it is quite unusual, because I will say most of the time when you're putting together these cases, this isn't something that it goes from, you know, ingredients to a cake. There's mm-hmm. a long, long way. There's months. There's so many people with, you know, putting their evidence in. So it's very unusual to see something like this, I'll say, first of all. But he's my first witness on the stand if I'm the defense attorney.
Yeah.
What would the purpose be to have this narrative that you want presented? I mean, a case is a case. What difference does it make how it presents itself? I'm just confused as to why they would even have a problem with this.
Well, I am going to say I recently went to some training, and the person presenting, long time, you know, FBI agent forever, was John Douglas, and he worked together, profiler for many, many years. Greg McCrary is his name, very famous, famous guy. And he did a great presentation about exactly sort of what you said, having a conclusion in your mind and working backwards to get it to match. And he presented this amazing case, and it was really important to understand how they got to the wrong conclusion. Ultimately, the guy was exonerated, convicted, and then exonerated. And I mean, you even had in that particular case, a guy in the lab lie about finding the guy's fingerprint. It was all false. So wow. These things can happen. And I really liked this particular training that I went to, because it's very important as an expert witness, you need to stay up on everything that can possibly happen in a case. And I really think it's important to evaluate all the evidence. And when you have a situation like we're discussing here, you have to take a tactical pause and look at how this could happen. So it's concerning.
Well, Jennifer, they say that doctors do the same thing, that when they walk into a room or they are presented with data from the lab, they get focused on here's what we think it is, but it could be something else. And they are so laser focused. No, it must be this, that maybe they miss a piece. And so you just brought that into my head that, you know what, maybe they got laser focused on this and now it didn't fit the narrative.
It can. I mean, that's certainly what can happen, mm-hmm. but I'm telling you, it is not the rule. It is the exception. I mean, you know, most FBI agents and investigators want to get to the truth. They want the right person behind bars. But some people do get tunnel vision. It happens. And you get so tunnel vision that you just can't see the forest for the trees.
Yeah. There was a comment that was just made here where it said, just because a digital forensic expert, I want to correct you there. There's multiple people. It's not just a digital forensic expert that's saying this is not there. You have multiple people on this case who were moved off when their conclusions did not go along with the said original theory of the case by the prosecution. So it's not just a one off here, because it just seems like that was kind of minimizing it or not understanding the full gravity of this. Fairfax had 12 homicide detectives working the case. Prosecutor Eric Klingon even said there were 24 different theories until Juliana, and we're going to get into her in a moment, this is the affair, gave her proffer. This is where she gave her statement, basically stating, we did it. And if I tell you that we did it, I get to go back home, right? And I don't get charged. They're kind of the little agreement that they made there. From an investigative standpoint, is it normal for a case to have that many competing theories almost 2 years in? And then we also have to start considering here, well, you got an agreement with your star witness who is allegedly part of this, but she gets to go off scot-free. As long as she continues to hold that torch and go down the line with the theory that you want presented. Seems a little questionable, but how common is this?
It's really not common. It's very rare. I'm not saying it doesn't happen. We've seen it happen before. But it's really rare for people to provide confessions, especially if they're detailed. Believe me, there's some out there. I could give you an example right now of somebody I'm thinking of, which is Dassey, who was a 16-year-old and confessed, and it's the worst confession I've ever seen on film, and it was so wrong. Yeah. But not to digress, sticking to this, it is really, truly rare. But what you have to do when you take in a confession is you have to really go through, in other words, the proffer here, and you have to look at every single minute detail and say, does that line up with the independent evidence so that we can corroborate what she says? And that's the snafu here with the digital analyst.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it took 8 months to arrest the au pair and 19 to charge Brendan Banfield. What does that timeline suggest to you about the strength or the weakness of the evidence in this case?
Well, whenever you look at the length of time that an investigation takes, it's going to take a long time if you are properly doing an investigation. Obviously, when you have a murder, you want to jump on that quickly because you have a murderer out there and you don't want to have somebody capable of murder free to possibly murder again while you're investigating. But it's critical that you do the investigation correct. Look at the David investigation. I mean, that is really dragging out. There's a lot of these that are dragging out. But I think all will agree it's so much better to do it right and get it right the first time than to speed it up and have it be wrong.
Well, and they probably were pretty certain that they didn't have like a threat to the community. This was an isolated event in this one house. They weren't concerned that the community was at risk at any point with this. So they probably could take their time.
So, Stacey, I will say this, and I say this with every case. I said it on Brian Koberger, most recently with the Tepe case, the dentist and his wife that were murdered. Mm-hmm. When you have somebody capable of committing that murder, yeah, they're not your target now. But what happens when somebody starts looking at them or something happens and they are worried about being outed or, you know, that's when they turn their attention at you. So people who are capable of these sorts of murders, they are always a dangerous to the community. End of story, because at any time somebody can become their target.
Thank you for that clarification.
There's the frame photo of Brendan and Juliana on the nightstand. It's kind of becoming a popular piece of evidence here that we know about. It was found 8 months after the murders. People are going, see, they were having an affair. We already know they were having an affair. That wasn't like really in question. We knew he was cheating on his wife with the au pair. Wife is now dead. They're together. It seems they're like kind of raising the kids together. They found love or whatever. It's an icky piece of evidence. It's one that if they did this, you know, it looks kind of shitty. But, you know, if this was some horrible situation that they truly did walk in on and, you know, wife is dead, they killed the guy that they thought was harming her. You know, it's not insanely ridiculous to, you know, if they were to fall in love and you know, be a couple all those months later. How damaging is the picture on the nightstand? You know, there's a visceral effect, you know, that people have in their guts. But let's talk about this from a more realistic perspective on reality's terms of, does it mean much?
Well, I people always want to see some verification that's in form of video or photographs, right? It's going to digress back to David and Celeste. Mm-hmm. all of those videos and photos because it's proof. It's proof of a situation, right? And we're all looking for that proof of them in bed together or some naked pics, right? We all want to see if that's ever going to come out to verify what everybody thinks in terms of that affair. But yeah, there's a visceral effect. People love photos and it shows what, you know, was going on, I think. So to some degree,
yeah. It's important. The prosecution's entire case here in the Au Pair Affair murder trial that's getting underway of Brennan Banfield, it comes down to one person, Juliana Perez Mangeles. She spent a year in jail facing second-degree murder charges. Then she changed her story, took a plea deal for manslaughter with time served, and agreed to testify against the man she allegedly helped commit double murder. She gets to go home to Brazil. All she has to do is say what prosecutors need her to say. But here's the thing. From a jail cell, she wrote to her mother, and she was heartbroken for what she was doing to Brendan, that she still loved him. So how does the jury weigh testimony from a witness whose freedom depends entirely on conviction? Jennifer Coffendaff, a retired FBI special agent, is here to help us break all that down. The sentencing is scheduled for after Banfield's trial. This is the scheduling for Juliana, meaning nothing or go back to Brazil, to ensure that she continues to cooperate. I mean, essentially, that means to ensure that she continues to say what we want her to say. If she doesn't say what we want her to say, they could say you're not going back home. I mean, this again, this doesn't feel like the free will of a witness in a case like this when you're holding literally her future in front of her.
And Tony, that happens every day in every investigation from the standpoint of we get witnesses that are jailhouse snitches. We get witnesses. Look, you can't get choir boys to talk about gang banging or to talk about murders, right? It's people who have their hands dirty in one way or the other in terms of the crime, because those are the witnesses to them, right? So you have to take into account, in my opinion, how does she hold up on the stand? How does she do in terms of what she said? It's always a problem when you have anyone change any, but in their testimony, I mean, for me, geez, it's tough. I mean, you start discounting what they have to say for me, not because of what you're talking about in terms of the, you know, going back to Brazil or they get a sentence reduction, but basically what I'm looking at is, well, you lied here. Are you lying here? Are you lying, you know, the whole time? So I think that's the biggest problem. And the jury's going to have to make that determination. I think many of us will be watching that testimony to see what we think.
Yeah.
I mean, and they got, you know, they obviously have talked to her before going into trial. I mean, I don't know how strong they believe their case is or how many blinders they have on, considering the amount of investigators who've been kicked off the case because their findings didn't jive with the theory of the case. How do you, I mean, and not necessarily talking in this case, but just more in general, how do you distinguish between a cooperator who's finally telling the truth because they want to tell the truth versus one who's saying whatever gets them out?
It's really very simple. It has to do with, can I corroborate the statements from independent facts? That's what the litmus test should be for all investigators. Anybody can sing a song and dance, but does that song and dance match up with your facts that you have in your case?
Sure. I'm trying to piece this together in my mind because I am disturbed by the investigative work on this. Mm-hmm. I don't necessarily believe that they're innocent, but it does raise some red flags. And I'm trying to parse that out in my mind. Let's just go down the road here for a moment of, okay, the investigators did figure out that it was the wife, the deceased wife, that was on FetLife, and maybe she was communicating with these people and was having these affairs or whatever. Let's just pretend that that's reality for a moment. Maybe it was. how do we get to where we got today? How does she end up dead? Is it basically exactly what they said they did as being reality, that this man with no criminal record who's living, I believe he was like living at home with his mom or something. I mean, the mom has all these lovely things to say about little Norman Bates or whatever his name is. And the way that their relationship was and how he was, and he was very calm and this or that, but he's showing up for a rape fantasy off of a website. So I got to question, just how stable the man is to begin with. But is that the answer? Is it, well, he showed up with the intent to kill her, and he was going to kill her, and he was killing her. And luckily these guys showed up and killed him too. Unfortunately, he killed her first. Is that just the storyline? Because, it doesn't match up extremely well to the blood spatter and such as well.
No, it doesn't match up. And look, I think, from what I know of this case, that they likely have the right scenario. But it is concerning in terms of this digital analysis. That's probably my biggest concern. But I will say, what other digital analysis was done? Are they going to have another expert that's going to replace the other expert that sees it a different way? I have not seen that evidence. Have you?
Mm-hmm. I have not. I don't know what that's going to be or if it exists or whatnot. Because I am curious. Because you got to look at it from the other direction too. Maybe there's some validation behind those people within the department who said you're never going to do this analysis again. Maybe they looked at it and went, "This is a shit report. Your methods, the way you did this, are not up to snuff. So yes, you did come to this conclusion, but the way you got there, we don't believe." Maybe they'll be able to come back and say that. I don't know the answer to that question yet, but it is alarming when you have multiple investigators on this case all getting booted because what their conclusions allegedly seem to have been did not follow what they want to put into this neatly wrapped box. Sometimes we do see this where the conclusions don't necessarily fit into the neatly wrapped box, but the prosecution isn't, creative enough or, I don't know the word I'm looking for here is, but they don't have enough to present it in any other way than the way that they've been saying it over and over. And it doesn't mean that their theory isn't true. It's just, they're not able to roll with the punches enough to continue to go down the road in an effective manner. And then they start creating these things that raise red flags, that raise questions of credibility and accountability.
Well, I feel like there's so much that we haven't seen, right? We're at the beginning stages. And yeah. I really want to see where this really takes us. I know what you're saying. There's concerns with people not being on the case that perhaps had different theories. And then you combine that with the digital analysis that was done that doesn't pair up because of who purportedly committed these searches. But like you said, how well of work did he do? What's his background and credentials in terms of, has he made mistakes in the past? What were his methods? And is there anybody that's going to come up and refute him for a particular reason? I mean, remember the 227 search? How long to die in snow? And then it turned out that was just when the browser was opened at 227, not when the search was conducted. So it's so critical to, I think, when you get into digital analysis is to really understand the methods and the expertise of the individual conducting the searches.
I mean, there's room for a lot of nuance here, without a doubt. And it's important to go into this thing, I think with an open mind and not just 100% in this way, because there is some weird stuff going on here. And if all we're doing is, maybe we do call out some bad behavior of the investigators, but it doesn't necessarily mean either that Brendan is innocent and Juliana is innocent either. The defense, of course, is going to be hammering Juliana's credibility. Does this trial at the end of the day, obviously they're going to have a lot of witnesses on the stand. They're going to have this expert and that expert, and they're going to pound it from both ways. Does it all though pretty much come down to Juliana's testimony and how she delivers and how she delivers it and how credible she comes across to that jury?
I think that's going to be a huge part of it. The the jurors are either going to take her one way or the other. Is it possible they could completely discount her credit or her testimony? That's even possible. And then now you're down to blood spatter evidence and the evidence from the scene. And I'm interested in all the details that they're going to have that show the web being woven. I want to see what all of those details come out, because at the end of the day, you're going to want to show this motive because you believe in that motive. If the jurors believe the motive, then the jury will likely convict.
It feels like there's a lot of room for reasonable doubt on this one. It really, more than I thought initially digging into it. And now that we're here and I've really dug a lot more, it's like, yeah, this isn't as clear cut as it just seems on the surface. Mm-hmm. There'll be a lot that will come out and we'll bring it to you right here. Jennifer Coffendaff, a retired FBI special agent, as always, thank you for coming on and giving us your insight into all of these cases. We'd love to get your thoughts as well. Be sure to put your thoughts in the comment section of the videos on YouTube, or join our Substack, hiddenkillers.substack.com. The link is in the description as well. Be sure to weigh in. It's absolutely free right now to join our Substack. Everything is free, no paywall. You can even get our stories a day before they land everyone else. So please do check that out and join us there, and communicate directly with us in the studio on the Substack. Until next time, for Todd and Stacy and Jennifer, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.